So, this weekend we were asked to do about spiritual rebirth. I think initially it was the chapter at around Vajraloka, Vajrakuta, but then it sort of came to Vajraloka and the team at Vajraloka. And but then, in a way, the themes that we've actually looked at over the weekend came more to the fore, so it seemed more important in a way to incorporate those into the weekend, but still keeping something around the theme of spiritual rebirth as a part of the weekend. So to keep some of the theme around spiritual rebirth as part of the weekend. And Tejananda has been preparing a talk for the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks, so he's been preparing a talk to deliver, and sadly the lamb ran out in his way, and here I am. I won't attempt to channel Tejananda, but I did look at his notes that he'd been making, to some extent to try to incorporate into what I'm going to say some of the points that he was wanting to make. Though I emphasise it's all my responsibility, not his, for what's said. It's really good living with Tejananda, so I'll just say I've lived at Vajraloka for the last 11 and a half years, and I've just learned so much. I've just learned so much, both from those conditions and from the others on the team, but particularly Tejananda, and particularly his deep desire to understand further the nature of the Dharma, the nature of reality. So I feel like I've been a beneficiary of his quest, and I'm just so lucky. I haven't felt all the time in my spiritual life feeling lucky, but at times I have, and definitely at the moment I feel really blessed in where I live, who I live with, and what I'm able to look at and to go into in terms of my own practice, and what I'm able to disgorge. That word comes from disgorge. to utter in terms of my understanding of the Dharma and also the tradition. So I feel very grateful to be in that position. I felt like slightly less grateful at the prospect of being in this position. But it's all right. It's all right. So, in a way, these last 10 or 11 years, I've been able to watch, be involved in the discussion around insight, around spiritual rebirth. And it's been fascinating. It's been fascinating. And it's been really positive. It's been really positive seeing the integration of different practices, bringing forth the deeper meaning of some of our traditional practices. So it's been a real privilege. I was trying to think what to say in terms of this. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, actually, I'll just talk about my life. I'll talk about my life and my relationship to the question of insight, the experience of insight, and just see where that went. So I thought that's what I'd do. So this will be, maybe it'll be a slightly wiggly road, but I hope I'll cover the important and salient themes. One of the things that Tejananda was wanting to do in terms of this talk, to, in a way, look at the difference between an insight experience and a seeing. What's the word? I'll look it up so I get the right word. A difference between an insight experience and a seeing and knowing, a seeing and knowing. And in a sense, that I'll try and draw out the difference between the two. They're both important, but in a way the seeing in knowing is more that something's seen and known and is seen and known. So it's like it's dropped, the insight has dropped into one's ordinary life, in a way. It's become an established aspect of one's life. And in a sense, an insight experience is informative and supportive and pointing in a certain direction. But there is a difference. There is a difference. So I'll talk a little bit about that. I think when I got involved in, I went to the Buddhist Centre in Leeds in January 1989, and I didn't have a clue. I knew that I suffered, primarily. I knew that I suffered, and I really wanted to do something about that and to be less anxious. And I knew that I also wanted to find out what was it all about. What is this all about? What is life all about? So a friend where I was working suggested we went and did a Buddhist meditation course. So that was how I got involved. And I really loved and appreciated meeting these other people who were interested in these questions of the meaning of life. And I really loved and appreciated the sort of, at that time, the sort of relaxed lifestyle that they were living, in comparison to my sort of career-driven service duty lifestyle that I was living. So I really appreciate, there was something very attractive about that. I think, in a way, the formative thing, and perhaps why I'm at Vajraloka now, is the first retreat, full-length retreat I went on, which was at Vajraloka, the 2 weeks on the Brahma Viharas. And on the retreat, I turned towards an area of suffering in my life that it was like I was haunted by it. And the conditions of the retreat were supportive in the sense of the Brahma Viharas, to be able to turn towards it and to fundamentally alter my relationship to it. So it was like something that had been fixed was no longer fixed in terms of myself. And out of that there was a sense, something was reborn, and certainly at a psychological level. And not long after that, I asked for ordination, and not long after that, I was staying in the community in Leeds, visiting and staying with them. And I was just sat by myself in the shrine room, and then I was sat there, and I was sort of doing a slight dilatory just sitting, and I was quite happy. And then red theatrical curtains opened. These red theatrical curtains opened, and I moved forward. I moved forward, and suddenly I was in a cave, and I was in a cave of infinity. There was a complete knowledge of infinity, and on the walls of this cave were, it was just full of jewels. It was just full of jewels. And each of these jewels was a possibility. And I started moving, and I started entering into one of the jewels, and again it was there was a knowledge of infinity, and knowing everything at the same time, and the possibility opening up, and it was just like the beginning of Doctor Who with the ghost down. Ghost down. And I had this thought, if I really go in here, I'm never coming back. And I had a moment of doubt about myself, and a moment of sense of a slight unworthiness. And then it ended. It probably only lasted about that long. But in a way, it was a significant insight experience. Because it affirmed what I'd done on the Brahma Viharas retreat, in affirmed the practices, and particularly around equanimity, metta and equanimity. So it affirmed those practices, it affirmed where I was, and it sort of gave me an indication of where I had to go in terms of self-doubt, in terms of letting go, and in terms of metta. So it gave me a direction. It gave me a direction to go. And so I went that direction. I gave up the work I was doing. And just before that, I'd moved into the community there. And I threw myself into the activities of the centre. So it was 1993. And I think there was a naivety, but also a really positive idealism in that. And it was a bit like I was reborn out of the life of a local government officer with his own house and car into the life of a community, no money, and infinite possibilities. And in a way, it was wonderful and absolutely horrible. Because I brought myself with me and all my habits with me. And the conditions, the idealism, but I began to see what the conditions I was landed in were in relationship to my idealised view of what they should be. And I still didn't really have a clue, in a certain sort of way. Not having a clue, I became Mitra Convener. Got ordained, became Mitra Convener. And in a way, certain habits I've brought from my previous life, particularly around duty, responsibility, and service, they got a good old run, and in a certain sort of way, in Leeds, they burnt themselves out. I'm not saying they're bad things. I'm definitely not saying they're bad things, but in a certain sort of way, they within the situation, they got burnt out, and in the process, burnt me out. In the process, those samskaras burnt me out. And I took over as chair of the centre around 3 years after I was ordained. The order sort of collapsed. There was a spontaneous combustion implosion, and I was the only one left standing. For a while, and I took over, and in a way it was just what was needed in terms of burning out these habits, because it provided the crucible for the burning out. I don't think there was a point where I had no money, and the centre didn't have any money, and I'd just taken over as chair, and I got a part-time job. And So I was trying to run this medium-sized Buddhist centre, part-time job, a community. Madness. But at the same time, there it was. And there was a point where, I think for about 2 years, I realised, because there was a point after 2 years where I relaxed. And I thought, I've not relaxed for 2 years. And that was salutary. That was really salutary. And I think I'll just say this for those who take responsibility. Just look, are you able to relax? Are you able to relax? Have you got the conditions to be able to relax? But there was one evening at the Buddha Centre, and I'd asked two or three other people, Mitchers, if they'd do little talks about their relationship to the spiritual life. And so they did. And it was delightful. It was really delightful. And at the end of the evening, I stood up and the thought went through my mind, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do anything. But it wasn't just a thought. It was like, oh, I don't have to do anything. And it sort of dropped down. And for about half an hour or so, 40 minutes, I just sort of wasn't there. Didn't have to do anything. And it was just a matter of I knew that the conditions required me to open my mouth and bring the class to an end and tell people to pack the cushions away and that sort of thing. And so that's what I did. And it was just so simple. It was just so, so simple. I don't have to do anything. And then slowly, after about the 45 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes, the this I-ness-y thing, it sort of worked its way back. But it gave me a sense of, I don't have to do anything. And it would be so much easier if I wasn't doing anything. I did say that. I'm not saying that it's not about no action, but if I wasn't having to do it, then it would just be so much easier, both for myself and those around me, I realised as well. So, and that sort of got me on a bit of a quest. It was a bit like the thought also sort of went through my mind subsequent to that. Oh, all I've got to do is get out the way. I've got to get out the way. Certain wrong view in that, but that was the thought. And it was a really quite supportive thought in terms of a relationship to practice and exploration around practice. The more I get out the way, the more I'm available, the less there's to protect, the more that the less agenda there is in relationship to experience and to other. So it sort of set a quest off, and I found myself, both by the conditions, I found I couldn't really do the practices, the metta and the mindfulness of breathing. What I could do was just sit. I was just too knackered to do those. So that's what I did. I just began to do more just sitting practice. And I began to look around what was available in terms of an understanding of the lakshanas, a deeper understanding of the lakshanas. And there wasn't a great deal that I could find. You know, this was in the days before electronic media. You could search, you know, like now it's wonderful, we can search the seminars, we can search for key terms and things like that. But there was a short section in the Three Jewels that I'd go back to around the lakshanas and the samadhis associated with the lakshanas that I did my best to look at and to reflect on. And one day I was walking up into Headingley to catch the bus to a class, and a wasp flew at me. A wasp flew at me, buzzed at me, and it was And I was so irritated by the temerity of this wasp flying at me. And as I walked on, sort of wasp flew past, I just saw the absurdity of that this wasp was somehow flying at me. Both in terms of the wasp having any cognizance that it was flying at me. But there's been something more about that over the years, that flying at me. That's interesting, flying at me. That I was there to be in the way of. And it's a bit like there's something around that. There was and that's one of the most absurd as it might sound, one of the most important insights that has sort of, in a way, I've been able to turn to that and look at my relationship to that over the years. So it's really quite a simple thing, and it's not just a wasp, but it's really full of possibility in terms of seeing through something. And things sort of got worse. Things sort of got better as well, but they sort of got worse in terms of my capacity to hold. In a way, the samskaras were further running out, and without those samskaras, what was left? So, and it was at a time where, for me, a number of people died in my life in a very really quite 2 year period of time. Five people, four of whom I was very close to, died, and in two car accidents, one suicide, one of cancer, and one of pneumonia. And that was really quite shocking in terms of, it was like the sights, About that time, the Asher Mitra letter came. And about that time, I was sleeping in, I had this scullery room out the back, was my room. And I woke up one morning, and this skeleton, 6'4", with a green nimbus, came through the door. And it danced around my bed. And the thought occurred to me, don't attach to the fear. Don't attach to the fear. And so it danced around my bed. And then it went in to the wall on the other side of my bed. And as it went into the wall, my ordinary wall came out. My ordinary wall came out. And I was sat up in my bed. And, there was something about that, the importance of realising around fear. Fear, in a sense, is just a thought. It's just a thought. And that the more you attach to it, the more that you're subject to it. So it was a pointer, again. It was a pointer rather than fully assimilated. I'd made one wise thing when I took on as chair. I said, after 5 years, I want 3 months sabbatical. So in that 3 month sabbatical, I thought, I'll go on solitary retreat for 3 months at Cookie Loka. So I went on solitary retreat for 3 months at Cookie Loka, which was a mixed bag. It was very cold. It was very cold because it was in the winter months. So I learnt about cold. And I learnt more about, I can just feel some tears on. I learnt more about just sitting still. I learnt more about sitting still. And just waiting. Sitting still and just waiting. And I learnt more about not being so dependent on other people. I think in retrospect I can say that. But I got back and I completely couldn't hack it when I got back after that. It was like I just couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't do it. And so it's like death. I couldn't, and it was like, just check the time. Yeah, it was like something like a death, but there still wasn't anything being reborn. And I got back, and in the end, it was clear I couldn't feed chair anymore. And then my health was shot. I was a perpetual migraine by that point. I was a perpetual migraine. And I handed on, Saminata kindly took on the work. And I still did stuff, but all my money had run out. It looked like my support was possibly going to run out. The community I was living had come to the end of its term in terms of a viable community. and I hadn't paid sufficient national insurance contributions to cover any meaningful benefits beyond. So there was this thought of, oh my God, I'm going to end up in this grungy bedsit next to the proverbial drummer. And then somebody said, oh, there's this job as administrator at Vajraloka. And this was quite important for me. There was a thought, you just open the door and you go through it. There's a bit, and that for me, that was like really important. I open the door and I go through it. And it's like it hadn't really occurred to me before. I just open the door and you go through. And you don't know what you're going into, but it's different. And in a way, I hadn't had that experience even when I'd given up my career job. So there was something about I was going forth from a certain way of being in making that move. So they offered me, I went down and saw Vajradhaka and Tejananda, and they offered me to be administrator, and I went out the frying pan into the fire. But there you go. But there were 3 square meals a day, a decent level of support, and and the full catastrophe. I think the first 7 months I got there, we were averaging on retreat 2.3 people. Shocking. It's changed. So it was a place which was right on the edge of going under, and. But we were sort of a new team as well, two others, Banerjee and Peter arrived at the same time. Something picked up. And in a way, Tejananda began to become more into his own, which will digress briefly. So Tejananda had gone off to see Shen Pen Hukum with a number of other senior order members. About 3 or 4 years before I got to Vajraloka, and they'd all had a very, very positive, it had a very positive effect on all of them in terms of practice, from what I can see, and in terms like Karmashila, Dharmarati, Vasantra, and in terms of a deeper understanding around awareness, And Tejananda, in his inimitable way, came back and was, well, just slightly intemperate, let's say, in terms of his critique of certain things to do in the movement. Which, it was interesting seeing how something that had taken place three or four years ago was still working its way through. So it takes a lot of time. So one has to be quite careful about, say, intemperate things too quickly, because they do take quite some time to resolve themselves or settle out into the history rather than the present of the movement. But what I saw when I got there was Tejananda clarifying. He was clarifying more and more how the knowledge he'd gained from this relationship with Shenpen Hukken and our system of practice. So that, like, what I saw was a man who was trying his best to integrate what he had understood within our system of practice. And I really benefited from that. And I really benefited in the sense that I was now in conditions where I could begin to explore more, at least. And I was also in the mental place where I could explore more. It wasn't just about Majjhaloka, it was also about myself, that I could explore particularly around, at first, around just sitting, and particularly around just sitting in terms of what's happening. So it's not just sitting, but what's actually going on in terms of what is this stuff thought? What is this? What are this stuff emotions? What is this stuff sound? What's the relationship of awareness of this to this experience? So it felt that I was blessed to be in the conditions where I could just sit and just sit and just sit. And what I noticed was that there could come points where a certain point of identification would just give way. There'd be just a giving way. And that was marvellous. And at the same time, I began, I'm not quite sure if it was before, what's he called? The chap who did the Burmese stuff. Kenny Folk and Hardcore Dharma chap. Ingram. Before, I'm not sure if it's around that time, but I found some of his stuff quite useful in terms of a clarity around the lakshanas, and also a bit of a clarity around the vibratory, the vibrationary nature of experience. And so I began to incorporate a turning towards experience and a more directly directed in terms of the lakshanas in relationship to experience. And what I noticed was that the mind really wanted to do it. What I noticed was the mind really wanted to find something out. So it was like I turn, and it was like something just else took over and just wanted to explore. And what it was wanting to explore was, what is this I? What's it made up of? What is it? And then there was a greater and greater clarity around that actually this I is just made up of thought. It's just made up of thought and feeling. And it's this point of view is just thought and feeling. And it became clearer and clearer that I didn't have to attach to that in the same way as I had. And so it was with that I'll just say that something was going deeper than there were insight experience, but something was going deeper than the insight experience itself. Something was going deeper into what I can describe as a way of being in relationship to experience and relationship to identity. Something was dropping down, dropping down, dropping down. And there was a recognition that I didn't have to get out of the way. That there was a recognition that I didn't have to get out of the way. That was sort of a wrong view. And then the next thing came along with Liberation Unleashed. Here we go on the roller coaster again. And marvellous. Marvellous. And what I saw was a real opening up and an opening out for people. It wasn't easy in terms of, because there were different responses from different people, it triggered off different things with different people. And it also, I've been trying to find this from Dogen. We had a bit of a study at Vajraloka, relatively early on, a commentary on some Dogen texts. And in it, there was this expression, the smell of rotten fish. The smell of rotten fish. And it's to do with holding on to an insight experience or a limited understanding. And it's a bit like you've caught the fish and then you sort of carry it around with you and you keep showing this fish off. And it's really nice, glistening fish to start with. But after a while, it begins to smell. And there can be something like that around either an insight experience or even some of this deeper stuff that you think you've got it, because there's whole swathes of desire and in will, etc., that haven't been integrated into it. So you think you've got it, and you want to show it off, and you really want to convince other people that you've got it and you're right. But it sort of begins to smell. So maybe there was a bit of that as well. I don't say for sure that there was, but maybe there was a bit of that that some people picked up the pungency of that. But in a way, the smell of rotten fish is just like any other experience. It's wonderful. And in a sense it is wonderful, because it's like something is cracking. Something in this veneer of who we are as a movement, as a sangha, as an idealized picture, is cracking. And stuff is really coming through. The stuff of insight is really coming through. The stuff of how do we connect is really coming through. The stuff of our own authority is really coming through. And relating to each other on our own authority is really coming through, which is absolutely essential in the times that we're moving into. So I'll try it out with Tejan and the LU stuff. So I think, don't think I'll get into trouble or him into trouble by saying that. So I did the LU stuff with Tejan and in a sense, there'd been a great deal of clarification before, but there was one significant clarification that I got from the LU stuff, was that there was like now a relationship to I identification. And before, and then there was sort of a recognition that, well, that was absurd. In a sense, there never had been this fiction of an I. There'd been a fiction, but it'd never been there. It'd never been there. And so that was quite liberating. And what I noticed was that it was like a little Dharma Vajaya thing had started up, and it just kept going. It just wouldn't stop. It just wouldn't stop. That sounds like it should be a really good thing, but it's just really quite frustrating. And it kept on looking for eye identification, just kept on looking. And this is quite important, and this is where models are useful where models are useful. So we've got the model of the fetters, which actually is really quite a useful model. No, all these models have to be held lightly, and in a way they're all images of something, and they're not to be over-identified with, but they are useful in terms of that they point to what needs looking at any particular point. If you stay looking at one area when it's gone past its time to be looked at, then it's a bit like it just keeps going round, repetitive strain injury in a way. And so it's like orientating towards something else. So I think, and I think this has been quite healthy because there's been this orientation towards greed and hatred, ill will. So, and that's really good because there's plenty of this stuff in us all, and it's not like you have to wait to deal with this stuff. The more you deal with it before, the less you deal with it later on. But it's like, there it is. And so turning towards, darkly, towards the relationship. Well, what is this stuff, ill will? What is this stuff, grasping, wanting, desire? Is it there? Does it exist? So it's like a new wheel turns. So, in talking about these things, and in talking about these things, there can be a bit of a discomfort because there's a held sense that somehow you'll be disapproved of. I'm not saying anybody's disapproving of me or anything like that, but there's a held sense that. It's slightly uncomfortable. So I could see it myself these last couple of years. I mean, slightly uncomfortable about expressing some of the things I've been expressing. Which is both, there's a certain culture within our culture, but more widely culturally, we're uncomfortable, I think, within the UK, of expressing stuff like we have to hide it under a bushel or something like that. So, what I was saying before about that there's, and what I can feel, what I sense is that I can't say that something's sorted out forever, because who knows really, but if I look in myself, that this relationship to I-ness is something's fundamentally changed. Something has fundamentally changed, which goes beyond an insight experience. So this is what I'm pointing at, is that there is a difference between the insight experiences and the process and the result of sort of fundamental changes. But I'm not going to make any claims. There's something else I wanted to say, but I'm not quite sure, so just give me. Two things. I just want to appreciate Satchidana, what the work he's done on this mapping. I think that sometimes he can come in for a bit of criticism, but I think what he's done has been very, very, very useful, very, very helpful in terms of the long term for our movement. And I just want to go back to something I was saying towards the beginning, is that. Why is this important? Why is this important? Well, the first thing is around suffering. So our own individual suffering. The more we identify with a particular perspective, point of view, identity, the more suffering we cause ourselves, the more restrictive we are, and the less open we are, and the more suffering we cause other people. The more we integrate insight into the other fetters, the more open potentially we are to respond to what's there, to respond to what's actually there rather than our idea of what's there. And the more the Brahmaviharas work themselves out, the more they work themselves out, because we're not trying to make the world correspond to our idea of the world. So the more we can directly respond to the needs of any particular situation on the basis of that situation, and the less we're separated from that situation. So in a way, the path is one of not intellectual cognizance. It's a path increasingly, I think, of the heart. It's a path of the heart. It's a path of greater and greater intimacy with our own experience, and through that greater and greater intimacy with the experience of others. I've been over the last 8 years, there's an aphorism of Bhante's that I've been going back to again and again and again, which is, love is the awareness of the being of another person. So love is the awareness of the being of another person. And by extension, love for ourselves is awareness of our own being. That quote was in the context of listening, but it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that. So love and awareness are, in a sense, just one thing. And in a sense, everything is just one thing. I think I'll finish there.